Ephesians 2 will be in verses 14 through 17 here in just a minute. I want to tell you a story first to get started. I was working outside yesterday, putting some storm windows on the second story windows of our home, and I needed to borrow a ladder from my neighbor who has everything, thank God, to actually make that happen. And I'm actually not talking about Matt Overman, who does have so much of what I need as well, but this was another neighbor. And I'm carrying this 24-foot extension ladder from his house across his front lawn and then across my front lawn over to these windows. And it's a big ladder. These things are fairly heavy, at least for a guy like me. And so I'm carrying it from his house. And as I'm walking parallel to the sidewalk, there's someone on the sidewalk, a guy who I don't know, but he immediately asked me a question as we're walking together. And let me remind you, I'm carrying something very heavy. I can't stop to talk. So I'm continuing to walk while we're having this exchange. And the question he asked me is about my neighbor's house. And I said, oh, actually, I don't live here. I can't answer that question. I'm not sure. And by that point, we're now in my driveway and kind of walking across our front lawn. And he says, oh, so you live here? And I said, yeah, this is our place. And then he makes a comment about Madison and the traffic on it, and we chuckle. And I said, do you live on Madison? And he says, oh yeah, I do. I said, oh, what house? Because I know Madison very well and always love finding out where people live on this stretch. And he said, well, I don't tell people that. You know, again, I'm carrying a heavy ladder, I don't stop in my tracks, but in my mind, I'm stopped in my tracks by that response. I don't tell people, he says. He says, you see, I'm a Trump supporter. And when I tell people that I am, I usually get a lot of flack for it. And so I just don't tell people where I live. I was like, wow. So this is the world that we live in. The world that we live in right now is a world where a neighbor does not tell his other neighbors where he lives for fear that they may act against him, perhaps even violently. That's the fear. This is the world that we live in right now, a world where we're tempted to believe that the best way forward is to separate from our enemies and get ready for battle. Now, in some sense, of course, where we find ourselves today is not new. Disagreement, separation, tribalism, conflict, even violence, those have been a part of our history from the beginning. I mean, it is an old, old story, an old, old way of being human. But as I want to talk about here, friends, and as I know you know, but I want to remind us this morning, it is not the only way of being. The old, old way of being human, this way mired in separation and in violence and in anger, and in tribalism, that is not the only way, and it is not the best way forward. You see, there is something new that is being done in this world if we are willing to join in it. And so that's what we're going to talk about today and in the weeks leading up to this election and in the weeks immediately following it. What kinds of people are we called to be? And what would it mean for our world, and by that I mean your world, your sphere of influence, your relationships, and I do mean the world at large as well. What would it mean for the world if we started to actually follow the way of Jesus when it comes to how we interact with people, including with our enemies? So for that, let's go to Ephesians 2, verse 14. We're going to break this up into a couple of chunks. So Paul is writing to a group of Christians in an ancient city called Ephesus. And in chapter 2, we pick it up here. For Christ himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility, by setting aside in his flesh the law with its commands and regulations. All right, so a couple things here. He has made the two groups one. The two groups that Paul is writing about were the Jews and the Gentiles. Jews, of course, being the people of Israel. Gentiles being everyone else. If you were not Jewish, you were Gentile in the eyes of the people of Israel. And over the centuries, Israel found more and more ways to keep themselves separated from the Gentiles. Now, in the beginning, this was perhaps well-intentioned. The people of Israel rightly saw themselves as people given a special mission by God to be a beacon on a hill, a light to the world, a light so compelling that the rest of the world, the Gentiles, would look at Israel and say, "Who are you? And who is your God?" They would be drawn to the God of Israel. And so Israel saw itself as called and felt that they needed, perhaps in order to fulfill that calling, they needed to stay separate. But that intention, if it was well-intentioned, quickly turned into something with poor outcomes. It led to a walling off of Israel, a creation of regulations and religious laws that kept the Jews and the Gentiles separated, and more than that, kept a hostility between them. Jews saw Gentiles as dogs, less than, second class, not favored by God, not loved in the same way by God. And Paul says here that Christ, in his flesh, in other words, in his death on the cross, killed, destroyed, put to death all those commands and those religious laws and those regulations that had been built up over time to keep Jews and Gentiles separated. Paul says Christ has destroyed that dividing wall of hostility. Verse 16, his purpose was to create in himself one new humanity out of the two, thus making peace, and in one body to reconcile both of them to God through the cross, by which he put to death their hostility. Hear that again. Christ's purpose, his purpose, was to create in himself one new humanity. Not a humanity stuck in the old, old dysfunctional ways, but a humanity that was new, a humanity fully alive, fully human. A humanity, frankly, that many of us might not think is possible. I mean, let me ask you, when you look out at our world today, the division that exists, the hostility that appears to be all over the place, when you think about how far apart people are, how deep the divide is, do you ever look out at this world and just feel hopeless? Like there is no way that the walls between us could ever change. I have no doubt that this is how the people in Ephesus that Paul was writing to felt as well. Because as I said, the wall between Jew and Gentile had been growing for centuries. Generation after generation had added their bricks, had practiced hostility, had promoted division. How could these walls ever come down. There was just no way. And then they did. I know it may not feel like it. But friends, as you look out at the world today, this is not the way that things have to be. We don't have to stay stuck in our old ways. Hostility and division are not our only options. Hopelessness does not have to hold us captive. A new humanity is being formed, and we are invited to embody it. And I'm just not sure there's anything more important. At least that's how it feels to me in this moment. Who we are in relationship to other people, perhaps especially in relationship to those we disagree with or do not like, those who are other, those who are our enemies, it matters. That matters how we live in relationship with those people more than who you vote for in a few weeks. Although I hope you vote and I hope you take that responsibility very seriously, but this is more important than that. It's more important than the numbers of the stock market. Although I hope you have what you need in this world, it's more important than the grade on the test. Although I hope you do well in school. You know, how we treat each other is a primary concern to God. In fact, according to Jesus, everything boils down to this: love God and love neighbor. And not just the nice neighbor who cuts your lawn when you're out of town, but the Samaritan neighbor, the one who you have been told you should despise. So, how do we become a part of this new humanity? How do we become a part of God's reconciling work in the world? Well, that's the questions we're going to go after today. And to do that, I want to invite you. I want to invite you to remember our shared origin. Remember our shared origin. You know, as it is so often the case when we are dealing with difficult and complex things, it is helpful to go back to the beginning. And so I invite you back to Genesis 1, the poetic retelling of how our world came into being, of our origins. And in Genesis 1, we learn important things about who God is and about who we are. And down in verse 27, we read this. So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. He created them. What do we learn here in this origin story? Well, first, although it's perhaps obvious, it bears saying that we are created by God. God is the source of your life and my life and every life to have ever drawn breath. And that is stunning to consider, that your very existence, the breath you take right now, arises out of a generous, self-giving love. God created a world in which you came into existence, and God saw that it was good. God delighted in creating you, and God delighted in creating your family and your friends and your enemies. But even more remarkable, I think, is this: that God created human beings in his own image, in the image of God, he created them. in the image of God. It's not just that humanity has a loving God as its source, but we are marked, we are stamped with the image of God. We bear the resemblance of the divine. And again, it's not just that a few of us are lucky enough to have this privilege. It's not that some groups get to claim this distinction while others don't. No, Christianity has always maintained that every single human being, without exception, was made in the image of God, which means that every life has indescribable value. Every person has worth and dignity. To be human is to be an image bearer of God. And when we remember this truth about each other, I think it can begin to change everything. Because here's the reality, friends. So much of our hostility between each other arises because we dehumanize each other. Again, to be human is to be made by God, bearing God's image. But what we often do is we dehumanize each other. We see someone on the other side or think of an enemy as less than human. Our enemies become something in our way, not someone made in God's image. And it is this dehumanization that keeps us stuck in this old, old way of humanity. You know, on Friday, we learned that President Trump had tested positive for the coronavirus. And not surprisingly, social media blew up with the news, with many people apparently wishing Trump ill, or worse, wishing his demise, explicitly stating that they hoped that this would be the end of his life. Of course, this is not the first time that Twitter, Facebook, whatever, would be used in such a way as this. I read an article yesterday about how when President Obama did various things in his presidency, people said very similar things, wishing for his death. So people of both political persuasions, of course, can give into the temptation to live out of this old way of being human. But I invite you to ask for a moment. I mean, on the one hand, it's not surprising that that happened on Friday, right? That was the reaction by some. But I just want to pause and ask for a moment together. And I would invite you to even ask your enemies this question. Where has this gotten us? This way of dehumanization, where has it gotten us? We are living in a world where right now some people are considering not going to Thanksgiving, not because of COVID concerns primarily, but because they fear that the Thanksgiving table could become a war zone. We live in a world where neighbors don't tell each other what house they live in for fear of retribution over their political views. I mean, the old way of being human has not worked, and it will not work. And so we must rehumanize our enemies. A new humanity requires it. It requires that we see again in those that we disagree with, in those who hold the opposite viewpoint, and those on the other side, whatever the other side of it may be, that we see them as fully human beings, made by God, bearing God's image. That's what it means to rehumanize our enemies. And when we do so, a few things, I think, happen. When we rehumanize those that we might want to hate, it repositions our heart. When we dehumanize those who are not like us, it hardens our heart towards them, does it not? When we dehumanize, we don't tend to grow to like that person more. We grow to like them less. And instead of love deepening its capacity in us, hatred begins to become possible. Our heart hardens. We begin to see that that person is not a person, but an obstacle. They're not someone, but something to destroy or to shout down. You know, our hearts get repositioned, though. They get recalibrated. They get realigned with the heart of God. When we look at our enemy and pause long enough, just long enough to remember that they have been made just like we have by God, and they bear God's image. So it repositions our heart. It opens the door to reconciliation. And let me be clear here, it does not guarantee reconciliation. For goodness sake, reconciliation is hard work. It is often long work. And it requires that the person who has caused pain or harm, if that has happened and the reason for the distance, love and justice and reconciliation require that that person would own their words and actions and would do what is needed to make amends. So reconciliation, again, it's hard work, it's long work. And to be very clear, the way of Jesus does not ask us to just gloss over pain or to just give people a pass. So this does not guarantee reconciliation. But I think without rehumanizing our enemies, I think the door to reconciliation remains locked, closed. It doesn't even open a crack. If we only categorize and label the people that we disagree with or the people who are on the other side, the door remains closed. So rehumanizing at least begins the hope. It gives us a shot at moving towards reconciliation. And then I would also add that rehumanizing helps us to not lose our own humanity. See, when I dehumanize someone, when I just throw them into a certain category, I dismiss them, I demean them, I see them not really as a person made by God, bearing God's image, that not only hurts them, it hurts me. There's a cost to my humanity the more that I dehumanize. And so, where do we go from here? What might we do today to begin to move towards a new humanity? Well, I want to invite you first to take the step of confession here together. I want to invite you and me to admit that there are times when I dehumanize, when I categorize, where I label, where I demean, where I see someone not as a person made by God, bearing God's image, but something far less. Could we confess that together today? And to do that, I want to invite us to listen to a song. Hopefully this one works without any trouble. This song was written this summer by an artist named Dee Wilson. You can find him on Spotify. And he was writing, of course, during a time of so much racial unrest. But and his song is about that, but it's also about so much more. It's about just the divisions that are present in our world today and the ways in which we separate from each other and Failed to live into this new humanity. And the driving line of this song is, we need you, God. We need you. And so I want to invite you to listen to this song, to maybe right now get in a position of attentiveness. And if you've been nodding off the last few seconds, I don't blame you. But now would you awaken again, and whatever posture, whatever position in your chair or wherever you are, so you could be attentive. If you have children who are old enough to listen to about a 4-minute song and to, you know, maybe consider its words, I'd invite you to call them back into the room if they're not there with you and invite them to listen to this song. And maybe give them a piece of paper, a pen, a crayon to write with. And I'd invite you to grab a piece of paper or to open a note on your phone. And as this song plays, to listen for a word or phrase that catches your ear that might be helpful for you to hang on to in this coming week. And then the last 30 seconds or so of this song, which are primarily instrumental and reflective. Again, we're going to hear these words, we need you now. And towards the end of the song here, I would invite you to make that anthem personal, to just in your mind, when you hear those words, we need you now, to just simply to yourself say, I need you now. I'm going to listen to this song, and then we'll come back together and share in communion with each other. But I'd invite you right now to let these words be a gift to you as they were to me. If you are able to stop your video, that is helpful for, again, anytime we're doing stuff like this. And without further ado, here's the song, The Medicine by Dee Wilson.
There's a sickness here that threatens to divide us, and we're all afraid to say its name out loud. Lord, I know that you can heal us of this virus, so we need you right now. There's a darkness here that's dangerous and aggressive. It's getting harder every day to shake its power. But Lord, I know that you can free us from oppression. So we need you right now. 'Cause we don't know what to do, so we'll turn our eyes to you. And we've run out of words to say, but if you come and have your way, you can save us from ourselves. Before our wounds hurt someone else, we need you now. What does it mean to have compassion for another? How can I claim the love of God that I can't see? If I can find the will to harm and kill my brother, 'cause he neglected to look like me. And I can speak the words of men and songs of angels, I can give all my possessions to the poor. But if your love can move the mountains of my hatred, somehow I missed you and I need you so much more. 'Cause I don't know what to do, so I'll turn my eyes to you. And I've run out of words to say, you can come and my wounds hurt someone else. I need you now. Yeah. 'Cause we don't know what to do, so we'll turn our eyes to you. And we've run out of words to say, you can come and have your way. Will you save us from ourselves? For our wounds you don't deliver us, we'll never be free. And if you don't change us, we'll never be better. We need you now. We need you now.
The words of that song that grabbed me were, we don't know what to do, so we turn our eyes to you. And I think that hit me because it's how I feel often. I don't know what to do in this crazy world we are living in. I don't always know how to interact with people who I don't see eye to eye with or more. And part of what we are invited to do is to look to the one who shows us how to love our enemy. You know, when they came to a place called the Skull, they nailed him to the cross, and the criminals were also crucified, one on his left and one on his right. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they are doing. And the soldiers gambled for his clothes by throwing dice. Now again, Jesus is not giving these people who are harming him a pass. He's not saying, oh, it wasn't a big deal, we should just gloss over the pain. No, justice, again, love requires that those who cause harm and pain own it and do what they can to make amends if the reconciliation is desired. Jesus isn't glossing over it here or dismissing it or pretending that it didn't happen. But his love is so great in this moment because he is so closely connected to the Father. His love is so great that he is able to let go of any need to take personal revenge on these people who are causing him harm. And that is what it means to forgive. It's radical, and there's no doubt about that. That's part of what we do in communion. In communion, we remember and we reclaim. We remember the radical way of Jesus, and we reclaim the invitation and the call to follow in his footsteps. In communion, we eat bread and we drink from the cup, not just to go through some ritual. In fact, that's not at all why we do it. We do it so that we remember the life of Christ and then to commit ourselves with what we have to the best of our ability to follow him, empowered by his Spirit to do so. So today, as we take bread and cup, we remember and we reclaim. We remember a life laid down and given up out of love for the sake of the world. A love so great, in fact, that he could see and remember that even those who were harming him were image bearers of God. So we take and we eat the body of Christ, the blood of Christ given for you. Take both, friends. Eat and drink this morning as we remember and reclaim.